Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Laura Pfeiffer, and I'm a naturopathic doctor helping you take your hormones from chaos to calm. In this podcast, I'm searching the internet, mainly Reddit, to find out what you are talking about. I'm diving into the questions you have, the things you are too embarrassed to talk about, and helping you navigate our healthcare system with ease. This is the Hormone Hub Podcast. Hello. Today, the post we are talking about is all to do with the vagina. The poster had posted something called 10 things I have learned about my vagina later in life than I should have. And so I want to go through, talk about these 10 things and highlight some of them so I can add my own twist, give you some extra information, some additional insight, and get into the stuff that you're really, that we're not talking about, that we're embarrassed to ask about. So let's start. Things I have learned about my vagina later in life than I should have. Now, some of these things I didn't highlight, but I'm going to highlight a couple more than 10. But let's just start. Before we get into all of these things that you should know about your vagina, I want to talk about the vaginal microbiome. So in order to understand all of these pieces, it's important to understand the importance of the vaginal microbiome as it pertains to all of the things that you should know about your vagina and your vaginal health. Let's start by breaking down the actual anatomy of the area, because when we're differentiating this is what we need to know. So the external area is actually the vulva, okay? So everything that you can see externally is the vulva. The internal area is the vagina. And when we're looking at kind of the, when we see that hole, so to speak, we're looking at the vulvovaginal area. Your vulva is the first line of defense to protect your genital tract from infection. So if we have contaminants that collect in vulvar folds, we have increased moisture, we have increased sweating, we have menses, hormonal fluctuations, which influence vulvar microbial growth and species balance, this can result in odor and infection. So when I'm talking about cleanliness and hygiene and all things to do with the vagina, we have to be really clear that I'm not necessarily talking about the vulva, okay? The vaginal microbiome has a balance of good and bad bacteria, similar to if you've heard me talk about the gastrointestinal microbiome. This plays a huge role in overall health, including your risk of developing infections. The vaginal microbiome in its optimal state contains high concentrations of lactobacillus species, and in a suboptimal state is characterized by increased bacterial species diversity and high concentrations of other bacterial species. This is important because I always talk about having diversity in your gastrointestinal microbiome. I'm talking about diversify, make sure that these good bacteria are able to grow and flourish and thrive. But when I'm talking about the vagina, a healthy state of a vaginal microbiome has high lactobacillus. In the fertility world, when we are giving or we're recommending probiotics for vaginal health, we are more often than not giving a very high dose lactobacillus containing probiotic. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in these, 10 things we should know. But I wanted to deep dive on the microbiome, the risks of infection, and that sort of thing based on that, so you can understand the next steps the next things I'm going to touch on. So we have higher states of lactobacillus species, and like I said, suboptimal, or anyone who has an infectious state would be characterized by increased bacterial species diversity and high concentrations of other bacterial species. So what impacts this? Well, we're wondering about all the things that could impact vulvar pH. So like I had said before, humidity, sweat, vaginal discharge, menstruation, urine and fecal contamination, genetics, age, soap, detergents, cosmetic products, lubricants, and spermicides. We're going to get to that. Wearing tight clothing or constantly wearing pads. So if you are the type of person that's constantly wearing, let's say, a panty liner because you're spotting all the time, this is something we need to address because it can negatively influence your vaginal microbiome. We talk about wearing tight clothing. And tight clothing can actually impact your risk of infection. Again, having something wet there all the time. This is why we talk about making sure you take off your bathing suit. If you have a wet bathing suit on after you've been in the water, you take off that bathing suit so that you are not getting that, wet environment staying around your vagina. Some shaving can impact it, prolonged drying of the vulvar skin. So again, it's keeping the balance of a clean, moist-ish area, right? We don't want to dry it out too much. We don't want to have too much moisture in the area. Vaginal pH, interestingly enough, much like the microbiome, varies with ethnicity. So one study found the vaginal pH of a healthy reproductive age Hispanic and Black women was much less acidic than of white and Asian women, which reflected a lower prevalence of lactobacillus species in these two ethnic groups. Now, vulvovaginal disease, which again includes the vagina and the vulva, is caused by multiple factors. So things like immune deficiency, hormonal changes, stress, or use of a vaginal douche or soap to clean the vagina, which can all impact the microbiome, leading to infections. Now, let's talk about the normal vaginal flora, the vaginal pH. This is all components of our defense mechanism. This is how we protect against infections. This is how we, build up our army so we don't get infections all the time. And so I always talk about the fact that when we have harmful bacteria, and typically I'm talking about this in the case of gastrointestinal health, if we have harmful bacteria, they outcompete those good bacteria. So the harmful bacteria are going to, thrive in that area, and the good bacteria aren't going to be allowed or able to take up residence. And I talk about this in gastrointestinal health with the idea of a community. So you're deciding to move into a neighborhood and you're with your real estate agent. You really like the house and you're like, I love all of the amenities that are around here. But your real estate agent tells you, well, just a heads up, if you move here, all your stuff's going to get stolen. Like, you can totally go to the mall, you can use the gym, you can use the sauna, like all of the amenities in the community you can use, but your stuff's gonna get stolen. And you're like, oh, well, I wanna still come to this community to use the amenities, but maybe I'm just gonna, live elsewhere. And this is what good bacteria do, right? So you're taking a probiotic, which is your good bacteria, but in the presence of bad bacteria, that good bacteria is going to come in and it's just going to come in, use the amenities and leave. This is why if we're talking about gastrointestinal health and you are taking probiotics, this is why it might not be working because the probiotics are just, there for a short time, right? They're like, we can't live here. We can certainly come for a little bit, but we can't live here because the environment isn't right for us to live here. And so we have to make that environment right for those bacteria to want to live there. And one thing in particular is group B strep that we see in pregnant women. This colonizes in the vagina through the gastrointestinal tract and can increase the risk of preterm delivery as well as other risks. This is something that if you're pregnant, typically we will swab and check you for. In a study of pregnant women, elevated vaginal pH without a vaginal infection. So we know that group B strep can be an infection, but in these women, just having an elevated pH without an infection was associated with preterm birth, a 30% greater risk of infection with HPV. So that's important. It highlights the impact of a pH, right? And so if your pH is off, if your microbiome is off, you're more likely to have things like group B strep. You're more likely to have things, if you're pregnant, preterm birth, right? So we see the importance of the vaginal microbiome. Specifically in menopause, as estrogen levels fall, the vaginal pH increases. And this alkaline pH is associated with increased harmful bacteria colonization. This is one of the many reasons why vulvar skin disorders are more prevalent after menopause. We have a lot of vulvar atrophy. We have a lot of, again, vaginal dryness. You are at risk of increased infections. Research has associated vaginal dysbiosis with an increased risk of many infections, including an increased risk of things like bacterial vaginosis and candida or yeast infections, but also the increased acquisition of things like herpes and HIV, right? Because the environment that we are presenting that infection to plays a role in the risk at which we actually get that infection. And so it's really important to understand that obviously, if someone has an infection and you have intercourse with them, you are more likely to get that infection as well. But having a really good barrier immune system and obviously protection, I'm not talking about that. Having a barrier actually reduces the risk of actually getting those infections. So let's go back to this Reddit thread, things that they've learned about their vagina later in life. And I'm going to add some of my two cents into this. Okay, number one, never put garlic or yogurt in your vagina, ever. I'm going to elaborate on this and I'm going to say never put food in your vagina ever. But I think going back to the intention of this note specifically is that a lot of women will actually try and treat bacterial vaginosis or a yeast infection, things I just alluded to, with garlic and yogurt, because yogurt equals probiotics and garlic equals antibacterial, antifungal, anti-inflammatory. Great. But from a food perspective, these can be really dangerous. Now, I have firsthand experience not doing this, but speaking to women who have done this and the amount of times that I've heard that they've burned their vagina by putting a clove of garlic in inside is astronomical. Something I would never do, something I would never recommend. There are products specifically tailored to treating this. A lot of products I'll recommend to my patients that don't involve putting actual food. I would never want you to put food in your vagina when we have a food versus a supplement or a product that has been created for that purpose. We've had a product that's been created as a suppository. We're not trying to make our own suppositories using food because garlic is spicy. And oftentimes what'll happen is the skin on the garlic clove, well, some people will just take the skin off, which like, whoa. But sometimes you won't intentionally take the skin off and you'll insert it and then the burn is something that I've been told does not go away. So making sure that you're actually A, getting the right diagnosis, that's really important. That's kind of the something I'll come back to this entire episode, because I think that a lot of times we, again, I come back to the embarrassment, the like, we don't ask questions about things we don't want to talk about, the your experience is your own experience, and you don't know what someone else is experiencing, so what you think is a yeast infection might actually be something else. So it is important to get a swab and a diagnosis, but with that diagnosis, we can actually create a treatment plan that makes sense for you. So that's the intention of the garlic and the yogurt, but I want to just say, as it pertains to like foreplay and intercourse, please do not put food in your vagina, okay? Because coming back to the microbiome, coming back to the pH, not only can certain foods have certain bacteria, depending on what foods you're actually using, but not even in the absence of bacteria, the food itself is not supposed to go in there. When we put it in there, we change the microbiome. When we change the microbiome, when we change the pH, we increase our risk of infection. And so if you're using, I don't know, a fruit or a vegetable, and it's, you know, got dirt or some sort of bacteria on it that would have really been benign any other time, but when you insert it into the vagina, you upset the pH, you upset the microbiome, and you're exposed to that bacteria, that can really cause problems. And even upsetting the microbiome on its own, everything has bugs. We're all made of bugs, right? And so when you put the wrong bugs in there, that can really lead to problems. And then again, I talk about changing the pH and increasing the risk of other infections, bacterial vaginosis, even though it's not a sexually transmitted disease, you can be at an increased risk of getting something like that by disrupting the microbiome. And then also, when food gets up there and you can't get it out, that is a problem, and that is calling for infection, right? We look at what happens when we leave foods too long on the counter, and we don't want that happening in our vagina. And we know that foods obviously get moldy, get rancid, everything else at a warmer temperature. Well, think about it at our body temperature, right? And so that's really important to note. So please do not put food in your vagina ever. Number two, this person wrote, advocate for yourself at the doctor and do a little research on your own. I had Mycoplasma genitalium for nearly 2 years before I found a doc who listened and treated me. Also, ureaplasma. So these are sexually transmitted diseases. It is important that you find a doctor who will take your symptoms seriously. But really, when it comes to your sexual health, not all sexually transmitted infections have symptoms. And so every time you have a new partner and you're not using protection, it's really important to get the proper swabs. It's really important to get the frequent testing. This is why, one of the reasons why we swab every pregnant woman, because A, you don't know, again, their situation could be anything, and you don't know when the last time they were checked. So to make sure that we're reducing all of the risks as it pertains to pregnancy, we do these swabs to rule out these infections. Typically, we're doing this early on in pregnancy. Usually they'll do a combination of swabs and or a urine test. There's a lot of things we can actually diagnose in urine, which it's really important to rule these things in and out. And so vaginal infections are actually one of the most common reasons why women see their doctors, which rightfully so. I typically am working with patients virtually, and a lot of the times I'm saying, have you had a swab? Because we cannot virtually assess your vaginal health. If you think something is wrong, please get the appropriate interventions, see the right doctor, get a swab, and rule it out. Because if you get a swab, they're also looking for things like yeast infections and bacterial vaginosis. If we can rule those things in, we know that maybe it's one or the other or a combo, or maybe it's something more serious that you need a round of antibiotics, and your what you thought was a yeast infection might not actually be that. So let's talk about symptoms where you would probably see your doctor. And again, like I said, not all sexually transmitted infections have symptoms. So it's really important that we get these things properly assessed so that we can know what the next course of treatment is and we avoid some of the more harmful outcomes like pelvic inflammatory disease or infertility, which is the case with things like chlamydia. So some symptoms you might notice, change in discharge, irritation, itching, redness, but it also can be asymptomatic. Another thing that will, lead you in the direction that something is going on that needs to be assessed is you thought you had a yeast infection, you treated it, your doctor treated it, or you treated it over the counter, and it's just not getting better. You thought you had bacterial vaginosis, and it's just not getting better. One of the things I see with my patients is I will see a case of a yeast infection, even if it's been swabbed by a doctor. The patient's confident that it's a yeast infection and they will treat it. It goes away and then it comes back. And then they'll treat it and it goes away and it comes back. And a lot of the times it actually comes back to the partner. And this is the same with bacterial vaginosis. It's technically not a sexually transmitted infection, but when you actually look at it, the kind of mechanics of it all, if you are, having intercourse and some of that bacteria that's overgrowing in the case of bacterial vaginosis is getting on your partner, and then their kind of microbiome is adopting that bacteria, but they're not having symptoms, then you have intercourse again and it reintroduces that bacteria. So oftentimes I talk to my patients about treating the partner depending on what issues we're having, if it's reoccurring, because I often find that when it recurs, especially with the same partner, it's a matter of your microbiomes kind of interfering with one another and causing this overgrowth. So when you have symptoms, obviously it can be a sexually transmitted infection or it can be from an irritant. So things like underwear, hygiene products, laundry detergents, lubricants, which can also cause irritation and discharge. And anything that's non-infectious would be called non-infectious vaginitis or inflammatory vaginitis, something that's causing a problem in the vagina, but it's not necessarily infectious or sexually transmitted. But like I said, treating the partner may be a good idea in these cases. Some symptom-free sexually transmitted infections include, like I mentioned before, chlamydia, which can be symptom-free but is really dangerous because it has bacteria that spread from the vagina to the cervix and can cause pelvic inflammatory disease, which in some cases can lead to infertility or troubles getting pregnant. Again, things like herpes impact the vulva mainly, but can also impact the vagina and the cervix. And then non-infectious are things like candida, bacterial vaginosis, can be tissue damage, things like that. Did you know that hormonal changes before and during your periods and during pregnancy can reduce the acidity in the vagina and leave you more vulnerable to the growth of bacteria that can cause disease? My take-home point of this section is to make sure you get a swab after every new sexual encounter
and try to use barrier contraceptions when you are with a new partner. And in the case of someone who is with the same partner, maybe not using barrier contraception because they are taking hormonal birth control or they're doing fertility awareness and they're preventing unwanted pregnancy in a way that they feel comfortable, is if you are getting a yeast infection or bacterial vaginosis treated, make sure that you're asking your healthcare provider, would it be a good idea if my partner is treated even topically in the cases of a yeast infection? Because this can stop the, you know, ping pong effect of these infections going back and forth. Number three, this one I have a couple of opinions on, and we can go back to our chat about the microbiome. But this third point, this person wrote, make your sexual partner at least wash their hands before play. A shower would be better. I don't know about this one. So my question is this really necessary? Again, let's just think about this. We're washing our hands and a shower. Now, going back to the microbiome, when you consider that pH changes are the largest contributor to infections and soaps and sanitizers can worsen pH balance, it may not matter. So one survey I found online, which was completely unscientific and not randomized, but I thought it was interesting. They found nearly 2/3 of those who responded said they had not washed their hands before intercourse. So I'll come back to, it's always a good idea to wash your hands. When you come home, you wash your hands, you know, get off the dirt from the day. I always tell my kids, as soon as they get home, you wash your hands. You take off your shoes, you wash your hands, you enter the house. And so I think hand hygiene is important. But do I think when you are already in your home, your hands have been washed, you don't have visible dirt, there's nothing that would, like, you know, cause you to say my hands are filthy and you're in your home, do you need to wash your hands specifically before foreplay? I'm going to say no. Washing your hands after is important. Again, it depends on the situation you're in. If you're in a situation, you just went to someone's house new, who's new to you, the first thing I do when I go into someone's house is wash my hands. And so you may have done that anyways. But do I think we need to associate sexual intercourse or foreplay with, you better go have a shower before you touch me? I think this sends a really weird message. And medical doctors agree with this, right? They say that the cases of vaginal infections, specifically after foreplay using hands, really are not skyrocketing. And again, like I said, if you're using hand sanitizer, in my opinion, if you're at home and you are not, you know, you just came home, you ate dinner, you washed your hands, you, like, you know, maybe cleaned the house, you're sitting, you're watching a movie, and you and your partner are starting to get intimate, do I think you guys need to break and go wash your hands? No, not necessarily. I think that you should wash your hands after, but I don't think you need to wash your hands before. I think that it's better in that scenario I just spoke about to not wash your hands than to use hand sanitizer and, you know, get right in there, because the impact, the irritation to the vaginal mucosa, the vulva, the pH balance, the microbiome, in my opinion, would be more harmful, and you'd be put at greater risk of getting like a yeast infection, bacterial vaginosis, or some sort of irritation from the hand sanitizer itself. And similarly with antimicrobial soaps, I'm going to get into this a little bit down here because one of the points has to do with something a little bit more related, but we're going to get into the impact of soaps and everything else on the vaginal microbiome. But one thing I will say to wrap up this third point is always, always, always pee after sex, because we want to prevent UTIs. Number four, buy the good toys and toy cleaner. The first thing I will say is you need to follow the instructions on your toys. When you look at some of the recommendations, many recommendations include basic soap and water and a clean damp cloth, but you can actually buy specific cleaners for toys used for, you know, foreplay and intercourse. And so what I would say is I have a couple questions. I did look at a few of them, and I couldn't find any research that really dove into the specific effects on the microbiome, the specific effects of these cleaners on the microbiome. And it just made me wonder if these cleaners are all formulated to you know, balance the microbiome, if some of them are made better than others, which I would imagine they are, and what that looks like from a microbiome, pH, vaginal health perspective, right? Because some of the cleaners were touted as natural and they used what I would see as antimicrobial oils. So things like grapefruit seed extract was in one of them. And I wondered if used regularly, what the disruption on the microbiome was. So if you were using a cleaner that included something like grapefruit seed extract, would you need to then make sure you were having maybe vaginal probiotic suppositories after using that toy? Or if you clean it and you let it set out, then really the impact doesn't really matter because it's, you know, aired out and the impact of that is gone. These are things I don't know, but I was wondering about as I was coming across some of these things. I did find quite a few UV cleaners, which I thought would be a really neat option because then we're not introducing, is this ingredient helpful? And are they using this as a preservative that's then going to be an endocrine disrupting chemical, right? I always come back to, are we using preservatives in these cleaners and are they endocrine disrupting? So when you put that in your vagina, the next time you use it, are we adding in harmful hormone disrupting chemicals? So I'm sure they are not all built the same. But when you are looking for toys, you want to make sure you're avoiding porous materials like PVC, looking for medical grade silicone, medical grade stainless steel. And one source I was looking at said medical grade glass. I don't know if I would want a sex toy made of glass, but I'm sure the ones that are glass are made really well because they would have to be, or that sounds like a lawsuit. So just making sure you're following the instructions, cleaning them correctly. Always look at the ingredients of any sort of cleaners or disinfectants you're using and make sure they are pH friendly for your vaginal microbiome and make sure that they are not full of, you know, preservatives and endocrine disrupting chemicals. A really great resource there is the Environmental Working Group Skin Deep database. You can typically search a product and see if there's any ingredients of note that you should be concerned with on there. Number five, take a probiotic if you can. And while we are on the theme of vaginal health, I'm going to talk about the specific strains you should be looking for vaginal health. Now, I will typically give probiotic for vaginal health suppository through a suppository, a vaginal suppository, or orally, or both. In the case of my fertility patients, right before a transfer, right before an IUI, I will do both an oral and a suppository. And the optimal vaginal microbiome of a reproductive age woman is typically low diversity and high abundance of lactobacillus species. And so just that in short, I specifically will tell patients we need to use a high lactobacillus probiotic for it to be beneficial for your vaginal microbiome. Okay, number six. If your doctor won't listen, tell them to write it in your chart that they refused to test or treat you. I am so sorry if you are going to a doctor about your vaginal health and they are not listening to you. In this case, I would agree, find a new doctor. Yes, get them to chart it that they won't treat you, but find a new doctor. And there are a number of women's health clinics that you can go to if you need specific things like PAPs and swabs and that sort of thing. There are like sexual health clinics that you can go to that you don't necessarily have to have a family doctor there. And the person there doesn't have to be your family doctor. So that's something just to know if you're looking for that support. Number seven, never douche unless you have cytolytic vaginosis and your doctor approves. I wanted to note that this person is saying and your doctor approves. So they're saying not everybody should be douching with cytolytic vaginosis, but I'm going to go ahead and say never douche. Let's just talk about what cytolytic vaginosis is and how it's treated. Basically, if we look at the difference between, like, let's say a yeast infection and cytolytic vaginosis, they can seem a little bit similar. And so cytolytic vaginosis is the abundance of lactobacillus bacteria. So I mentioned that that's the main good bacteria in the vagina, but too much of a good thing. is a problem. And so what I find is this is typically a diagnosis of exclusion. So we may think that the patient has a yeast infection visually, symptomatically, and then further treatment reveals that it doesn't get better when we treat for this yeast infection. And so our second thing is we get a swab and we rule that out, but it could be cytolytic vaginosis. And even in this case, I would not do a douche as a treatment. Typically the treatment is a sitz bath of baking soda and water. So normally I just make a bathtub with baking soda and water, or you can actually do a sitz bath if you have from postpartum, one that goes on your toilet and you can, you know, just sit in it. It'll be fine there, because I mean, the baking soda might impact your skin, but whatever's easiest, you can, like, you know, put a bucket in your bathtub, whatever works. I would not recommend you douche. And here's why. A Canadian study actually found participants who had used any vaginal or genital health and hygiene products in the 3 months prior to this study had approximately 3 times higher odds of reporting any adverse health condition. Specifically, the use of gel sanitizers were 20 times more associated with the odds of having a yeast infection and bacterial vaginosis. The use of both feminine and baby wipes were associated with higher odds of a UTI, and vaginal moisturizers or lubricants were associated with higher odds of both yeast infections and UTIs. Vaginal douching was actually associated with higher odds of a yeast infection, bacterial vaginosis, and a UTI. Over the past decade, there's been a surge in intimate hygiene products for cleanliness and odor control, but we have to be careful. Some may actually upset the pH in the vulvovaginal area, impacting the composition of the normal vulvovaginal microbiota needed for the protection against infection. One study found that women with vulvar use of bubble bath were twice as likely to have bacterial vaginosis, and bacterial vaginosis was 3 times more common in women using antiseptic solutions in the vulva or in the vagina. Further, bacterial vaginosis was 6 times more common in women using a douching agent. So do I think if you have cytolytic vaginosis, you should douche? No. I think you should get the right diagnosis, and I think maybe a sitz bath would be helpful, or treating the root cause if it is not, in fact, cytolytic vaginosis. And so making sure that we're not, you know, treating one thing and causing another is really important as well. Vaginal douching has long been associated with the acquisition of bacterial vaginosis, and longitudinal data suggests that those who douche are at an increased risk of incident bacterial vaginosis. The effects of other intravaginal practices are not well studied, although some have been shown to kill bacteria and may be more associated with bacterial vaginosis than others. So again, douching, using gels, creams, lubricants, we have to make sure that they are pH friendly. We have to make sure that they are microbiome friendly, and we have to make sure that they are not endocrine disrupting, which is a huge thing as it pertains to women's health. Number 8, and I actually really like this one. It doesn't really have to do about the vagina, but maybe kind of. Number 8 was pregnancy tests can be found at the dollar store and are apparently just as good as the more pricey ones. I'm going to take this and I'm going to raise you ovulation test strips as well. So, Let's just get back to pregnancy tests. Just because it's from the dollar store doesn't mean it doesn't work. I will say, though, that pregnancy tests from the dollar store maybe not as sensitive as the ones that you're paying more for, because some of them are made to detect the pregnancy hormone sooner. So the 6 days sooner ones or whatever else the case may be. But in all honesty, the ones from the dollar store are going to be the same as the ones that you'll get in your doctor's office. So for example, for me, when I was pregnant with my second, I had a rapid test, a 6 day sooner test. I was planning for that pregnancy, and I knew that there was a high possibility that I was in fact pregnant. So I went to the doctor when I got my, you know, my 6 day sooner test, and they did their test and they were like, yeah, you weren't pregnant. I said, yeah, I am, but that's fine. I'll come back in 6 days. So they just aren't as sensitive, but yes, they do work the exact same. And if you are testing, especially if you were trying to get pregnant and you're testing, like, you know, every single day or every single day, I mean, every single month, you should not test every single day, every single month, you know, month on month on month, then getting the less expensive ones is very important. So let's talk about ovulation test strips. Now, These can also be purchased at the dollar store, and oftentimes I'm recommending my patients purchase them on Amazon. There is, I'm going to name drop, Premom, because Premom can be found on Amazon very easily and comes with an app, so it makes it easier to interpret. Ovulation test strips are harder to interpret, so it's important that you get that app or get one that comes with an app, because with a pregnancy test, like a line is a line is a line. But with an ovulation test strip, you're looking for the degree of darkness on that line. And this is where we can differentiate it. This is where it gets confusing. And this is where it can get a little bit messy. So making sure that you are working with someone or having the support of someone who can help you interpret those will be very beneficial here, because they are hard to read. But all in all, when it comes down to it, you can buy them at the dollar store. You can buy them in bulk on Amazon. You don't need the fancy ones with the smiley face to detect your luteinizing hormone. Number 9, not all of your symptoms will match what you read online. Get your doctor to check you for any unexplained concerns. I can't stress this enough. If you feel like something's going on, and you are looking online, you are trying to do your due diligence, you're asking friends, you're asking family members, you're trying to see like, well, what could be going on with me? When this happened to you, was it like this? When this happened to you, was it like that? It's really important to understand that you are unique in your genetic makeup, in the way your body responds to things. And so it's important to get tests done. This is why with my patients, I test all the time. I don't guess, because everybody is different in their presentation. I see this so commonly with hormonal health. I see this with digestive health. When I do a GI MAP test on a patient who has gut issues, I come back with results and I'm like, oh, I'm shocked by this, because you presented in a way that didn't predict this for me. And I have someone else with the exact same results come up and they presented in a way that was completely different. And I think it has to do with a multitude of things, right? It has to do with your genetics, your diet, your lifestyle, your sleep, your stress, everything else. And so, yes, we can do a good job of finding information and empowering ourselves to ask for certain things as it pertains to our health. But it's really important we take that information that we find online, we let it go through our filter in our brain so that we say, this is interesting, I'm going to hold on to this, and I'm going to bring it to my doctor to discuss. And this is my patients do this. They say, hey, Laura, I learned online this. Do you think that this is relevant for me? And we can go into it as to why I think it might be relevant and why I don't think it's relevant in certain cases. And number 10, stress can delay your period. If you are a patient of mine, you know that I talk about this all the time. But stress can delay ovulation, which can delay your period. And so what happens? When you are stressed, your body's making cortisol. Your cortisol helps you run from a bear. It helps you get out of danger. It helps you fight or flight. Now, your body is going to favor stress hormone over sex hormone. Your body is going to say, I don't need to reproduce when I am under stress, so I am going to, you know, get out of here. So yes, stress can delay your period and stress can delay ovulation. Stress can also impact your fertility in that way, right? If you are delaying ovulation, if you're not ovulating one cycle because of stress, that's going to impact your fertility. And I'm going to add 2 things, because I've wrapped up the 10 things that this person learned about their vagina later in life than they should have. And I'm just going to add 2 things to this. Smoking. Smoking has been associated with an increased prevalence of bacterial vaginosis. Several compounds from cigarette smoking are detectable in the cervical mucus of smokers, one of which has been associated with the induction of bacteriophages in lactobacilli. Recent data using sequence analysis have shown a correlation between smoking and dysbiosis even after adjusting for other factors. So if you are a female and you smoke, it is going to impact your microbiome and is going to lead you susceptible to more infections. And diet. There is an association among increased dietary fat, a higher glycemic load, and a lower nutritional density with bacterial vaginosis. Additionally, glycemic load is significantly associated with bacterial vaginosis progression and persistence. So if you are somebody who is suffering from chronic bacterial vaginosis, you need to start looking at your diet. You need to start working on blood sugar balance and a more nutrient dense diet. And finally, bacterial vaginosis has also been associated with obesity. And so there are a lot of factors at play. There is some research looking at vitamin D and other things to do with your vaginal health. And so if you feel like you've hit a dead end as it pertains to your vagina, or if this information has opened your eyes to, wow, I should probably talk to someone about my vaginal health or my vaginal microbiome, let me know. Hit me up on Instagram, Dr. Laura ND, and I have the same username on TikTok. It's been lovely. Thanks, guys. We'll talk soon.